Radio City once again. Rob Ross and I, John Grayson, here with you to talk about the latest in the world of popular culture and what's going on elsewhere in politics and everything else that you'll find on the page at popdose.com elsewhere if you look around a little bit. And Rob, we've got so much to talk about. It's hard not to start with what we've seen over the last week or so, coming out of not only the aftermath of the Las Vegas shootings, but Puerto Rico, and of course, the aftermath of Tom Petty, which once again has taught us that everybody on the internet is an absolute asshole.
This is true, but before we get into that, and we are going to get into it, I want to bring up something that you and I talked about a few weeks ago, maybe a month or two ago. That is, right now, I have in my hands, as you can see, and the listeners can't see this, but I assure you this is a visual. I'm holding up in front of John, because he's also on camera with me, a bag of Kit Kat Minis and a bag of Reese's Minis. Now, these are both milk chocolate, and I'm deferring to you, Mr. Grayson, because I have no choice. They aren't making these in the white chocolate version. So I just want to say, hashtag white chocolate lives matter. Hashtag, white chocolate privilege.
Yes. Well, there is plenty of that.
Hashtag, take your fucking milk chocolate hands off of my white chocolate supply. Hashtag, vanilla fudge.
Well, I love the reference to Slade in that. But yeah, it's that time of year again. I mean, we've got 30 days left until Halloween gets here, or not even 30 days left until Halloween gets here. And so we're going to be assaulted with every pumpkin spice fucking thing in the entire world between now and then. And of course, all the candy as well.
I swear, as God is my witness, we went grocery shopping this morning. I cannot tell you how many things were infested with pumpkin spice on it.
Right.
Why? Somebody very cleverly on Facebook, one of those rare moments when there was a bit of wisdom used, somebody did a package of Ernie Ball Extra Slinky Light pumpkin spice flavored.
Yes, of course. And of course, the Meineke Muffler place somewhere out in the middle of nowhere that had a sign out front that said pumpkin spice brake pads are back. So that's good to know.
Yeah, that is righteous.
It's all going crazy.
Well, that's the world we're currently living in. And, you know, there's blame on both sides.
Yeah. Well, and see, that leads us right back into this Tom Petty thing, because D.W. Dunphy, in his infinite wisdom, noticed that it didn't take very long for a backlash to occur where one was never even called for. I mean, a week ago when we were doing our conversation, it was on the heels of getting the information that Tom Petty had died. And it was one of the toughest things that we had to do, was kind of pull it back together and not let our emotions run away with us. And it didn't even take 24 hours for the first people to start coming in and saying, big deal, I'm not a fan. You know what? If you're not a fan, go find something else to do.
You know, it may sound cliched and hackneyed and tired and so on, but if you have nothing nice to say, keep your mouth shut.
Right.
You know, you weren't asked. Your opinion wasn't solicited. There's absolutely no sense in that whatsoever. But the thing about the trolls is, as Dunphy pointed out so accurately in his piece on Popdose, is that there seems to be this incessant pathological need of the troll to start the fire and to provoke people, especially when they're emotionally distraught. And I'm sorry, but this is one of the most emotionally trying stories that we've heard about a musical hero to so many being understated. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and Tom Petty himself was loved universally. And I cannot tell you how many conversations I've had during the span of the week, on email or on social media, with people from all over the planet who just absolutely loved him and are devastated and are still trying to process the fact that he's gone. Tom Petty was huge. Tom Petty was beloved. The music was huge. The music was beloved. It crossed all different factions and tribes and whatever classification you want to put yourself into as far as your musical leanings. Tom Petty was loved. And the thing is, people who do this, and we're not talking even specifically now about Tom Petty, but whenever someone that's beloved passes, someone has to go in there and piss on the charcoals. And it's not only tedious, I think it's the one place where everybody has the right to turn with their pitchforks and spears and axes and just chop this person to ribbons verbally because there's no place for it. We're supposed to be adults. We're supposed to be rational adults. And here again, just like with the political bullshit that we've been listening to for a year now, going beyond, we're talking about now in the aftermath of the election, but this is more of the same bullshit that we've been hearing for the last year because there are some people who just cannot resist being a complete and an utter provocateur slash dick.
Right.
And that's the only word to use.
Exactly. And that's the thing. And as DW points out in his article, he says, you know, he refers to them as the quote unquote too cool to mourn crowd. And that's it. And the fact is, being an asshole doesn't make you cool. If you want to show me how cool you are, then say something like, you know what? I don't get it, but I respect it. That's cool.
I think I saw that maybe once or twice.
Right. Right. And
that
and if you want to say that, that's fine, because I've said that I don't know how many times about people who get all weepy about country singers. It's the same thing. It's like, I don't get it. It's not my thing, but I respect that it's yours. So I'm sorry to hear that you're hurting.
You know, it's the fact that people go out of their way, though, to be so vindictive. That's the psychology factor at work. Like, what is wrong with you?
Right. Right.
You know, but someone did bring up the whole, it's no different than the people who go on their little rants and tirades about how this one did this and that one did that. And it's the old, you know, as I always call it, and you've heard me say this many, many times, you know, you didn't give me a cookie when I was five and that's why my life is a misery. You know,
right.
Dad didn't buy me a pony.
Yep.
So now I'm traumatized for life, you know. And the thing is, it is still very, very difficult to digest that Tom Petty is gone. I mean, during the span of the week, I don't know how many times I've heard his songs, and every time I have to fight the tears back and the urge to cry.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very difficult thing, and it doesn't matter what song it was, whether it was something from Wildflowers or The Last DJ or, you know, God forbid, Hard Promises, which I made the mistake of listening to because I was bawling like a baby.
Yeah.
Or the fact that last night NBC ran an old Saturday Night Live from 1979 where Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were the guests and they did Refugee and Don't Do Me Like That. And I was just in tears.
Right. And you look at what else has happened in reaction to this. And you had Jason Aldean opening Saturday Night Live last night. Now, Jason Aldean was on stage when the shooting started in Las Vegas. So he opened Saturday Night Live with a rendition of I Won't Back Down by Tom Petty. At this week's football game in Gainesville, where Tom Petty hailed from with the Florida Gators out on the field, they played I Won't Back Down over the loudspeakers, and every person in that stadium was shouting that song at the top of their lungs. And if that doesn't move you, there's something fucking wrong with you.
You are absolutely 150,000% correct. I was absolutely bawling when I heard the people in Gainesville. That was a little too much for me to take.
Yeah,
my
right.
wife was to tears. When I turned on the TV last night, because I didn't realize that Saturday Night Live had begun, and I don't watch the show, but I wanted to watch because I wanted to see Gal Gadot and how she was going to handle the, you know, being on Saturday Night Live, being an Israeli, all the bullshit that she's had to deal with because she's Israeli.
She was great, by the way, yes.
Plus I wanted to see how she'd look, which was just, oh, dear.
Stunning.
God, oh, fuck. She's the kind of woman that makes a gay man go straight. You know, I mean, that is just, oh, she's got legs up to, she's so good. She should be continued on to the next girl.
There you go.
She's so adorable. Holy shit. But back to seriousness, you know, I turned it on and I'm watching and I didn't realize this was Jason Aldean, but I'm hearing this guy singing Won't Back Down and I started to cry.
Yep.
Again, because it's the whole Tom Petty thing. And then when I saw this morning that it was Jason Aldean and then I saw what he had said previously, I thought, you know what? That was perfect.
Yeah.
That was perfect. And you know what? Don't think for one moment the detractors, the know-it-alls, the too cool for school, you call them what you want, weren't coming down on him. Well, you know, he knows what side of his bread is buttered on, and, you know, he's a country guy. And, you know, somebody very wisely and astutely said something that went through my mind and then something that I'd said to my wife, and that was, he was on that stage. You weren't.
Right.
We weren't, you know? How do you know what to think or what to say after you've experienced something like that, you know? The fact that he had the guts to get on a TV stage, you know, in front of this multi-million crowd being transmitted to and say what he said, you know, he didn't get up there and make a political speech.
Right.
He talked about the pain of it and how do we get through it? And I thought it was perfect and spot on for what it was and what it needed to be, and the double poignancy of a song like Won't Back Down, and the fact that it was a tribute to Petty and it was straightforward and no bullshit, no funny business, made it even more salient. And yet all of these dicks are out there. Well, Ariana Grande had a better approach because she visited the victims in the hospital in Manchester. Again, you weren't there.
Yep.
He was on that stage. How the fuck do you know what he did in the immediate aftermath or not? You know, maybe he's also not seeking any form of publicity after something like this. But see, this is the problem with trolling, what you and I have talked about as far as social media goes. You know, it's all well and good to, you know, have your balls and your dick grow a foot and a half when you're hidden in the shadows of social media.
Right, yeah, that's never going to come off as brave to me in any way. And by the way, let me get one little peccadillo out of the way, because there's been this push not to mention the name of the guy who was the shooter in Las Vegas. And I kind of understand it. I mean, I think it's magical thinking gobbledygook in some levels, and in fact, in most levels. But okay, fine. If that's the decision you make, that you don't want to, you know, remember him or give his name any power, then fine, go ahead and do that. But it's left news people in a kind of a weird conundrum, because they're looking for a way to refer to him without saying his name. And twice in the past 4 days, I've heard him referred to by news people, one of them Jake Tapper and the other one some schmuck on Fox News, as this gentleman. The guy murdered 58 people, and we're going to call him a gentleman? How about we not do that?
Well, because news media right now pander.
Yeah, right, exactly.
That's all it is. It's pandering, you know? It's, and again, it's both sides. You know, it's the conservative media and it's the liberal media.
Right.
And they're all full of shit. You know, how about you do your job? You call him by name and say who he is and what he did.
And say the facts and then be done with it. Right.
Here's a novel concept, you know. What's the difference between a thug and the guy in Vegas? It's a murderer. A murderer is a murderer is a murderer is a murderer. It doesn't matter. He killed 58 people. It's like the whole thing about wanting to know the motive and blah, 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 blah. If he didn't blow his own brains out, we might be able to find out what the motive is. You're going to drive yourselves crazy and get absolutely nowhere, as you already have been doing to begin with,
right,
trying to figure out a motive when you're not going to find it. He left seemingly no traces, not his political affiliations, nothing. Nothing that gives you an inkling that he was going to do something so heinous. He committed a mass murder. That's all there is to it.
You know what? And in a way, I'm glad he did it that way, because knowing a motive... Let me ask you something, Rob. Honestly, what good does that do anybody?
Nothing, because it doesn't bring the dead back. It doesn't heal the scars that will never go away for the people who were wounded. Nothing.
Not only that, there's even a little bit more to it than that, because let's say we did know what his motive was, what it was that set him off. What would people do with that information?
Oh, they would start pointing fingers immediately.
Right.
Of course.
Right. You know, they'd start clobbering each other with the same bullshit that has left us this divided in the first place.
You know, if it was, it's no different than that woman who was on CBS who, did we talk about her on last
week's
show?
Yeah, we did. Yes.
Okay. You know, and she's a lawyer to boot.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
It just makes it even better. You know, but you get people like that coming out of the woodwork and saying, well, you know, country music fans are all right-wing gun toters anyway. Okay, that's great. You've already dug a hole for one side. But what if he was a left-leaning kind of guy?
Right.
And that's why he attacked them, you know? Then what?
Yeah.
It kind of puts a very murky light on the precious left.
Right. What if he thought the same way you do, lady? All of a sudden, you're in the same camp with a guy who just murdered 58 people.
Right.
Now how do you feel?
Now, well, you know, there are bad hombres on both sides. Blame to be had.
We're right back to it again.
And this guy's right, because this guy's about as bad an hombre as you're going to get. But if he was left-leaning, oh boy.
Right, exactly.
And Black Lives Matter crowd fucked.
Yeah.
Because all your ballyhoo is for naught in one fell swoop by this lunatic doing what he did. You don't need to define him as a thug, an assassin, a terrorist. He's a murderer.
Yep.
That's all there is to it. A murderer is a universal word that fits this guy to a T.
And right. And as long as the next time there's a Fort Hood or a San Bernardino or a whatever, or, you know, a nightclub shooting in Orlando, that it's dealt with the same way, then everything is fine, which is why this bias in the press, no matter what direction it goes, is such a bad thing to begin with. And they know this because they all went to J school, but they don't put it into practice once they get out in the public. And it's just, it's terrible. But you're right. Charles Whitman was a murderer. Ted Bundy was a murderer. Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugit were murderers. That's it. That's all you need to know.
Ed Gein was a visionary.
All right, fair enough. Now, I can't move on from that, but we're going to have to. So we get into a little bit of music. And for the last, I guess this is the fourth week in a row we've been doing this, taking a look back at the seminal year in music that was 1984 and the changes that came up. And I have to lay this one right at your feet, Rob, because I have to admit, you picked out a band for our 1984 look back this week that I, of the three we've talked about previously, am less familiar with than any of them. Although I did know the name and I went back and listened to this record, and you're right, it's amazing. Where are we going?
We are going to Arizona, and we are going with the Meat Puppets, who released one of those albums in that wonderfully, cosmically unreal week in 1984 when we saw the release of Zen Arcade by Husker Du, Double Nickels on the Dime by the Minutemen, Let It Be That by the Replacements. SST Records sought to release Meat Puppets 2, the second album from this trio, who didn't fit anyone's notions, preconceived or otherwise, of what punk rock was. But see, here's the thing. SST saw visionary bands, because otherwise they wouldn't have signed the Minutemen.
Yeah.
The Meat Puppets were not like any other band. They were acid-soaked, for a start. They looked like hippies. Were unabashedly unashamed Grateful Dead fans. But these guys could play like a motherfucker. And that's the only way to phrase it, because when you hear this record, never mind the fact that this was one of the best produced sounding things that ever came out of SST, especially during that period, they played with an intensity and a ferocity and a firepower and a speed that you were just astounded by.
Yeah.
And it was simply laid at the feet and virtue of their talents as musicians. The Kirkwood brothers, Kurt and Chris, and their friend Derek Bostrom, the drummer. Those three were such fine and tooled musicians, but yet when they played together at that breakneck speed, you could hear the consistency and coherency in the music, even though it was going by at 500 miles an hour.
Yeah. Well, and you picked out the thing when you started that really struck me first, is that the first thought I had about this was, if I was writing a review of this record, I'd say this is probably the only band I've ever heard that could have counted the Sex Pistols and the Grateful Dead as influences.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair point. It really is. And the thing is that the songs, while of a punk rock speed and nature, are all fully realized, fully formed, thoroughly melodic. But when you hear, I mean, my God, you hear Kurt Kirkwood's guitar playing. It is this virtuosity that I couldn't even find the words to really match it. Because he is one of the most criminally overlooked and underappreciated guitarists of the era. You know, yes, much later down the road, when they slowed things down and they moved over to London Records and so on, and they actually had a minor hit in the wake of the whole grunge thing, which was very unfair lumping in, because obviously they were well ahead of that genre and curve. You know, you go back and you listen, you work your way back through Meat Puppets albums, and you hear the textures and the style and the playing and the flair and the dynamism of his guitar work, the intricacy. And I mean intricacy. You know, this album has a lot of songs that are considered nowadays, of course, standards and classics by the older punk, you know, guard or community, if you will. But you know, when I first heard the album, because like you did back then, you didn't buy just, okay, I'm going to go buy the Minutemen record. You know, you picked up the Minutemen, and you picked up the Hoosiers, and you picked up the Meat Puppets, and whoever else looked cool at that moment, or were in the ad with it. The first time I listened to this, you know, and I heard things like Lost and Plateau, and Lost, of course, was a song that the Minutemen covered, I think, two or three times on various albums. You're sitting there going, wow. Then, of course, Lake of Fire, which was done a decade later by the likes of Nirvana, that was something completely different. But the one track that really signifies to me the entire oeuvre of the Meat Puppets is New Gods. You listen to that, and that is blistering. It is absolute firepower of guitar playing that I can't even begin to think of who else could have played in the same kind of proximity and the style. But the sound of it, just the sheer sound, when you hear New Gods, you hear the guitar work, and then you hear the almost stressed and strained and squeezed vocals ranting about in Mexico not to touch the water, you know, they can only you can only drink Pepsi Cola, is hysterical, and it's brilliant. But listen to it and play it really loudly and tell me you're not blown back in your chair by it.
Yeah, and when you're talking about that kind of guitar work, you also have to ring in on the fact that, I mean, not only was it melodic, as you said, but it was also very full sounding. And that's where we've had this conversation about trios before. The biggest trick to it, whether you're talking about ZZ Top or the Meat Puppets or anybody, if you've got three guys, you have a lot of room to fill. And they didn't seem to have any power or any trouble doing it. And it seemed like the energy that came from the rawness of the sound was what they really used to kind of build that extra man.
Well, that's the whole thing about the Meat Puppets. Certainly right up into the mid-90s when they did expand into a four-piece after a lineup shift. But that's neither here nor there, because when you're talking about the essence of the Meat Puppets at their classic best, that trio fleshed out every inch possible. When you listen to Derek Bostrom's drumming, it's a very – he moves along with Chris Kirkwood's bass. You know, it's – how do I put it? You know, first of all, as a rhythm section, they weren't just holding the bottom end. They were galloping along at their own at their own pace, and it was really Kirkwood just kind of working his way and weaving his way around it with the guitar melodies. But the way his guitar sounded, the intonation, and I'm guessing, because my memory is not serving me quite right, but I'm guessing he used a Les Paul back then to great effect on the warmer side of it rather than trebly. So that way it could sound a lot fuller and a lot warmer, but no less heavier, because when you listen to the riffs, they are as heavy as you can get, even though, again, they're going at 500 miles an hour. So this is one of the – this is probably the one album in all of that 1984 period that probably does not get its due when it should. But we're here to talk about it because it was one of those watershed moments, you know. I mean, I rank this up there right after – you know, Zen Arcade and Double Nickels. You know, I put this one, frankly, and personally, ahead of Let It Be.
Well, yeah, and one of the things about it is that, I mean, when you talk about using the guitar to that kind of effect, is that there was a chiminess about it that you didn't find in a lot of other punk. And I think that using a lot of chorus and a couple of other effects sparingly and kind of one at a time, but it just in a way that it made it enough without becoming cloying or overbearing was the real trick to that in the studio. And whosever idea that was, my hat's off to him.
My guess is going to be, and it's just a reasonably educated guess by sheer logic, a combination of the band and Spot, who was their producer, and he was the in-house producer for SST anyway. Yeah. So they probably told him, this is what we want, this is how it's going to sound, because certainly the Minutemen sounded the way they wanted to sound, you know.
Right.
Boone on the very high treble all the way up end, and Watt on the very low end of the bass with two very distinctive channels. And with the Hoosiers, it was just, you know, Mould with his MXR distortion box and his electro harmonizer, and, you know, the high end, and going through an Ibanez Rocket Roll Flying V, and Greg Norton's bass just being a straight channel flat right through, you know. That's how you always kind of got it, you know.
Nothing like somebody spending $200 on a guitar and making it sound like a million.
Well, the funny thing is that guitar nowadays, if you can find one, especially like on eBay or one of the guitar used guitar sites, they go for about $2,200-$2,300.
Yep, right, right.
Because that's the lawsuit era.
If only, but, if only we had known.
Tell me about it. The interesting thing that I want to – there's a little postscript to this SST conversation that we're having right now is that yesterday was the first gig in a year by the Bob Mould Band out in California.
Oh, wow.
And somebody very wisely taped it from the beginning. Now, I hope somebody's got the complete – opening of the show, because apparently he said something incredibly emotional about Grant Hart, and they opened the show with Never Talking to You Again. They opened it, he played it straight first, just guitar and vocals in him, and then the band kicked in and it just killed. And like hearing Tom Petty all week, it reopened that wound, and you're not going to sit there without feeling the tears coming on, because to see Bob Mould doing a Grant Hart song was not only touching, it was incredibly powerful because of all the meaning behind it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I couldn't have thought of a better postscript to that whole story, because that kind of just seals the fact that I'd like to think that the hatchet had been buried between the two of them. Certainly, there's a picture of the two of them from not too long ago. They're both smiling at the camera. They're together. So it says to me that, you know, maybe bygones were finally bygones under the worst possible circumstances, but still bygones were finally bygones. And that was just an incredible and very overpowering gesture by Bob Mould, but it was an incredible rendition. I know that both John Worster and Jason Arducci, who are the rhythm section of Bob Mould's band, were both enormous Who's Purdue fans and had enormous respect for Grant Hart. So that was an act of love. Great. What that was.
Yeah, that's nice to hear. And again, that brings us to the end of Meat Puppets 2, but one that I'm fairly new to and still in love with as much as if it was 1984 all over again. So thanks for that, Robin. We've got a lot more to talk about. And in fact, one of the things you just mentioned, that idea of taking and splitting stereo into a very distinct left side, right side affair, is going to come up a little later in this conversation as well. But we've got a little tube to talk about first, because now we're into the fall season, and right now, with a lot of the series that I've been kind of watching through their first 7 or 8 seasons, the ones that have lasted that long, I've been relatively underwhelmed with what I've seen. And I don't know if this is a hangover from the streamers taking all of the talent away from the writing rooms in these places, but it looks like somebody's got a lot of work to do. However, there are a couple of diamonds in the rough.
The one in particular that I found so far is a new show on ABC. And again, it's an interesting fact that it's on broadcast television. A show called The Good Doctor, starring Freddie Highmore, who, if you remember, just recently got through playing the role of young Norman Bates in Bates Motel.
Yep.
He's a very good actor. Most people will probably recognize him as having played Charlie Bucket in the remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And I'll tell you what, he's one of the few English actors who can pull off an American accent flawlessly. They either go with a southern accent, or they all sound like they're trying to come from Brooklyn, but sound more like they're from Boston. So it's this really bad bastardization of the whole scale voice. But he's an excellent actor. And the premise of this, first of all, it's apparently a South Korean based on a South Korean series. He plays a young neurosurgeon who happens to be autistic. And to be able to pull this off is absolutely stunning. His performance alone is worth watching because he's so good. He seems very adept at what you would, I hate to say it, expect someone with autism to be like. But he does it in such a very natural way that you're riveted to the performances. And of course, he's surrounded with adversity because there are people who are, you know, his betters or his seniors on the teaching staff that don't want him there. But the president of the hospital / teaching school does. He's a family friend, which is why he brought him there, because of his phenomenal skills and his savant-like nature. 2 episodes in, and I'm already hooked. Hopefully, it will sustain throughout the course of the season. And another one that's interesting, but I've only seen 1 episode thus far, is this new show with Jeremy Piven, who I think he's usually a bit of a tool, but he's kind of interesting, called Wisdom of the Crowd, and that's about crowdsourcing crime solving. He plays this Bill Gates type tech whiz whose daughter was murdered a year previously and has basically walked away from the company that he started to create a platform for real-time, crowdsourced crime-solving. You know, any clues, every clues, if you see the suspect, you know, you start following him and tweeting. And so that was an interesting take on things.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, too, in light of the fact that there was a news story about that a couple of weeks back when some Nazi asshole or neo-Nazi punk up in Seattle was going around and making a nuisance of himself and yelling at people and walking around with a swastika armband on and doing the Sieg Heil at everybody. And Twitter found him and some guy beat the shit out of him. So, you know, sometimes the things like that can actually happen and crowdsourcing can come in handy.
Right. I mean, there you go. Now, when the word Nazi is used and it's some dickhead walking around going Sieg Heil and wearing a swastika armband, you deserve to have your brains bashed in.
And he did. Right.
And so that's not social justice warriorisms. That's doing what's necessary.
Yeah, that's called a logical conclusion. So
for business.
Now, that having been said, there is one other TV thing, and I know it's about as just absolutely generic popcorn television as you can possibly get, but my lovely bride happens to be the same age as I am, and she's female, which means she has to watch NCIS. That's the law. So she does, and the one saving grace that show has is that the woman who plays Abby, and now for the life of me, her name is escaping me, but she was in The Ring. She played a bit part in The Ring years ago, and she's popped up in a couple of different places. But she's really fun to watch, and not just because she's cute. She's just fun to watch. She's an interesting character. And now she announced that she's leaving the show. So in a way of a little surprise in our heads, can you think of a time when there was somebody who left a show like that, or, you know, just left a show that you were into in the middle of watching it and you thought, boy, that's somebody who's really going to be missed, no matter how they left?
Sure, a whole bunch of them. But first, are we talking about Pauly Perrette?
Pauly Perrette, yes. Thank you very much.
Yeah, she is cute in a very punk rock, gothic, okay, you're a little too old for the get it, but you're still cute kind of way.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, let's go back to Saturday Night Live when Belushi and Aykroyd left.
Yeah, right.
You know, the 79-80 season was beyond difficult, and I mean beyond difficult, because there went 90% of the comedy. I hate to say it, because you had the interaction between everybody, and no matter what, you couldn't pick up losing the samurai. You couldn't lose, you know, Leonard Pinth Garnell. You couldn't lose, well, the station manager who would do a point counterpoint with Jane Curtin on Weekend Update. It hurt that show, and it hurt it, and it did make it unwatchable. So you stopped watching, you know. But there are other shows that I can think of. Certainly, you know, I mean, at the point that it happened when Ron Howard said he was leaving Happy Days, it was, well, you know, Fonzie had already jumped the shark anyhow.
Right, right.
That's kind of a moot point. But still, when Louise Lasser left Mary Hartman, well, that show became even more popular and much more accessible by becoming Fernwood Tonight, you know. But that's a different thing.
You know, Fernwood Tonight may still be one of my favorite moments in television ever. I mean, that it didn't last very long, but you know what? What was there and what is still on videotape is absolute magic. And, you know, there was also, during the 80s, during the run of when NBC owned Thursday Night with Cheers and Night Court, how many people died? I mean, Selma Diamond died. Nicholas Colasanto, who played Coach on Cheers, died. I mean, those shows survived.
You're bringing up a really good point, because that was the next one I was going to go to, was Cheers. You lose Coach, but then you bring in Woody Harrelson.
Right, and kicked off his career.
Gem, and I mean an absolute gem. And after this segment, I want to talk about a movie that I just saw with him, which is phenomenal.
Great. But
he was a gem, and he was perfect for that role, because you needed a dim-witted bartender foil for Sam regardless. Let's face it, Coach was kind of a tard, and Woody was just he was punch drunk is what he was. You know, Woody was just a total mongoloid, and that made it better. But then, you know, what's her name, Shelley
Long, she also left.
Left. You know, she's the co-star, because don't forget, you know, the show was built around her, as she had said. and was supplanted by Kirstie Alley, who turned out to be magnificent.
Right.
Because she was the perfect foil for Sam, because she was genuinely funny. She could actually trade lines, but it also helped by expanding characters like Frasier and Lilith, who I thought were the show stealers, frankly.
Right. You know? Well, right, and there were times when it didn't also work out as well as they thought it might, because remember when David Caruso left NYPD Blue to start his movie career?
I'm sorry, what movie career? Jade?
Exactly. You know,
all I remember is this much, John. Be a dick like Caruso in Jade.
Yeah.
Just answer the question with a question. Okay?
Always. And I mean, that crashed and burned, but of course he rebuilt his own career on CSI Miami later on, doing the same shtick he was doing both in that movie and on NYPD Blue, so...
Except he got the Daltrey scream after he dropped his one-liner.
Right.
Which really, if you think about it, was the thing that was created by Jerry Orbach as Lenny Briscoe.
Yes.
You know, just for the da-dum, da-da-da-da-da.
Right.
Which
again, I mean, there's another one, not only a departure from him because, well, his health was failing at the time, but also... Yeah, I mean, how many times did they roll over that cast and you had Angie Harmon come through there, which, by the way, thank you. And, you know,
and Carrie Ross.
Right.
And Elizabeth Rom and Diane Neal and Michael Moriarty was the first of the DAs, and then Sam Waterston.
Yep.
And then, of course, Stephen Hill, a.k.a. Mr. Dan Briggs, who was the original leader of the, you know, Impossible Missions Force, but we won't go into that. You know, supplanted finally by Diane Wiest.
Yeah.
And then Dalton Thompson.
Right.
I mean, Jesus.
Yeah, going from being a senator from Tennessee to being one of the stars of Law and Order, yeah.
But I'll tell you, well, you know what? My introduction to him was when he was on, do you remember Wise Guy?
Yes.
Okay. He did one that was hysterical. He did an arc, as they used to call it on that show. And remember who the stars of Wise Guy were? It was Ken Wahl as Vinny Terranova.
Right.
And it was Jonathan Banks as his sidekick slash minder.
That's
okay.
Right.
And I will never forget, Fred Dalton Thompson played a, quote, preacher, in quotation marks, the Reverend Knox Pooley, who went out there to preach his Zog philosophy. Got all the crowds whipped up and riled up and blah, blah, blah about white supremacy and white power, and it's the Jew-owned media and blah, blah, blah. And what happens in the end of the arc there? They find out that he's nothing but an embezzler. He's full of shit. He has absolutely no political – he doesn't give a shit about politics or anything. But because they – and the great twist was while all of his henchmen go to jail for the crimes they committed against the Zogs – by the way, that means
– Zionist Occupation Government.
Right. Thank you. But because I'm a Jew, I don't say these things.
I remember that from talk radio.
I just have myself armed at all times, and I look for anybody who even looks at me funny. I'm training to be an Israeli mentally.
Attaboy.
For my chance with Gal Gadot, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
At the very end, it turns out because they can't get him, he has to go free. And the next thing you do, you see him selling real estate in Florida to this old Jewish couple. You know, it was brilliant because he played it the way most of those douchebags always play it, you know? And that was my introduction. And I was like, wait a minute, wasn't he one of the fucking prosecutors in Watergate?
Yeah, right.
Now! So, you know, that was, but there you go. Now, on the flip side of it, a show being hurt by not its stars leaving, but the people that supplemented those stars. A show that was absolutely at the top of the charts when it premiered in 1978, and I think you know what I'm about to say, was Mork and Mindy.
Yes.
And they tampered with the format after the first season. They took the whole subplot away from the fact that, you know, Mindy's father didn't approve of Mork, you know, and her grandmother was there to be her father's foil. And they made it this really stupid and meaningless story, sub-storyline with a New York deli and bringing in Jay Thomas as the wisecracking deli owner.
Yep.
And his annoying sister. And it just – you knew the minute that it aired it was going to be bad news. And that show never recovered from it.
Right.
It went on for about four more years, but it never recovered.
No, and even what they try to do later on with bringing in Jonathan Winters in that schmaltzy, he's their kid storyline and all that, and it didn't work. The only thing that they did when they were monkeying around with Mork and Mindy that I thought was brilliant was when they brought in Tom Poston to be their landlord, and he was just the same disaffected ass that he was on every other appearance, and he was great, but, you know, there wasn't enough of him.
A poor man's Foster Brooks.
Yeah.
You know? Like he was loaded, right?
Right,
he
right.
Had one Coors too many.
Right, and that and Robert Donner is Exidor, who they, you know, they even though they utilized him plenty, it still didn't seem like it was enough. But if you're looking for something to do, in fact, this is a good time to be talking about it because he just got out of prison again. O.J. Simpson. They did a storyline on Mork and Mindy where Mork lands in jail, and I don't even remember for what. It doesn't matter. But Robert Donner as Exidor ends up in the same jail cell with him. He was put in jail for vagrancy, and if you remember the character, he always thought that there was this cadre of people around him that were his followers, but there was nobody there. And so he was telling Mork, he was explaining to him that he had started a new religion and that he was worshiping O.J. Simpson. This is obviously long before that. This is when O.J. was still playing for the 49ers. And it's hilarious. I mean, it's about 2.5 minutes worth of the funniest television you will ever see.
I can think of a few others, but none that really had the end, because that's the show that always struck the loudest chord with me, because I loved it when it came on.
Yeah.
But after one season, they ruined it.
Right.
And, you know, like I said, it never recovered. But there are other shows that have had to suffer the losses of some stars, not always the star of the show, but, you know, we just mentioned Wise Guy. And by the end, well, actually it happened twice during the show's run. Ken Wall got hurt. He was always prone to accidents, unfortunately.
Right. Yep.
But he got hurt, and he was out for quite a while. And a guy named Anthony John Dennison, who's a very fine actor, actually, took over the role playing a different agent and did this fantastic arc. I think that was the one that Jerry Lewis appeared in, actually.
Yeah.
He was terrific. And what they should have done, actually, was because then Ken Wall, of course, became a problem with his contract. They should have just kept Anthony John Dennison in the role. Nobody would have missed him.
Right.
Would have missed Ken Wall, and the show could have kept going because it was so well written.
Right. And well, and right now you look on Netflix, and one of the most successful series that they have going on Netflix right now is Ozark, starring Jason Bateman, whose career was kicked off when another star left her own show, the one with her name on it, Valerie Harper, left Valerie. And then it became Valerie's Family, and then it was just the Harpers or whatever the fuck the Hogans, right. And Sandy Duncan came in to replace her, and that show went on for another 6-7 seasons after that.
And the thing is, Jason Bateman started his career as being the pain in the ass, smart alecky sidekick friend to Ricky Schroeder on Silver Spoon.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Now, why I just remembered that, I have no idea, but it's probably your bad influence.
Yeah, it's got to be me. But it is. You never know. And that's the whole point, is that you never know what direction it's going to go. Maybe the show falls apart. You take the right piece out. And Pauly Perrette's not even the first one to leave NCIS. She's probably the fourth or fifth one to go. Because they had Ziva before her and Kate before Ziva, and Tony was gone as of this season. So they've had plenty of turnover, but she's one of those characters that you expect to always be there. And I think she's going to be much tougher to replace. So we shall see.
Well, it's always I before E except after C. I mean, the bottom line is that somebody's going to wind up, you know what, you whether it's a contractual thing, look, I'm going to give you perfect examples. There's this fairly new show on CBS called Kevin Can Wait with Kevin James,
yep,
which premiered last year, in which he plays a Harry dad, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
You know, with the annoying wife and all that. Apparently, they killed the wife character off in the off season.
Right.
After one season, you've already killed the wife off. And who do they bring into the show to supplement that? Leah Remini.
Right, who was there with him the last time. He was playing this same character. And it makes a lot of sense because the chemistry between the two of them on that show was so good. You know, even though the show itself was meh, but they worked really well together. So why not?
The problem is, though, that show also ran itself into the ground because we got too much of them for 8-9 years. okay, we've seen them. We don't need to see them together again.
Right.
And, you know, here's one that's not going to suffer because she was indeed a minor character, but the way that a show handles things is Blue Bloods with Tom Selleck. Unbeknownst to the audience, the character of the wife to Donnie Wahlberg's character died in the off season, and nobody knew about this until the opening show. You know, how do they explain it? She was a nurse, and even though she was trapped in a house fire at the end of last season, when their house was being burned down by a thug who wanted to kill Donnie Wahlberg's character, she escaped the fire. She was killed in a helicopter crash transporting a patient.
Of course, so we can at least make her heroic on the way out. Which,
right.
By the way, speaking of house fire, and I have to get this one out of the way too, since we're talking TV series. I loved This Is Us, the first season. The first episode of this season was really, really good. Enough. Just do the reveal. Stop with this. Let's drag it out and give you one piece of information per show. That show's an hour long. Just lay it out there and get on with it.
See, that's the thing about these new shows that like to do this whole new nouveau thing about the reveal.
Yeah.
Fuck the reveal. How about just giving us a solid storyline that keeps us tuning in week after week?
You know, it's amazing we get along at all, Rob.
Well, that's because we're both cut from the same cloth, you know?
Yep.
We're brilliant. We're visionaries. We're, you know, we're take no prisoners. We're old school. You know, you and I were both there in the trenches and I'm slugging it out. We're stationed in Poontang on the road to night train, you know, and slugging it out against Charlie, hip deep in rice paddies. Well, all these pussies were home, putting on headbands, and listening to their fucking Beatle albums.
Exactly. So, on that subject, you mentioned a movie you saw with Woody Harrelson.
Yeah, it came on very, very accidentally. It was called, ironically enough, The Edge of 17.
Huh, okay.
A movie starring that, I think she's quite a wonderful young actress, Hallie Steinfeld.
She was young
who was, as a little girl, was in the remake of True Grit, and she was fantastic in that. She's turning into one fine actor. I mean, she was terrific in what's that movie with Mark Ruffalo where he plays the washed-up music producer? She was terrific in that, but she plays this, you know, very pissed-off, disconnected teen who has no friends. Woody Harrelson has this – he's an intermittent character throughout. He plays one of her teachers, and he is so – from the moment he's first on the screen in this movie, you have to watch it. If you have Showtime, you've got to see it. It's on demand.
Okay.
He's fantastic. She's fantastic. Kira Sedgwick is terrific as her sick of this bullshit mother. I mean, it's a great film. It's entertaining. It's funny. It's also believable. You know, it's not cartoony. It's highly believable for the here and now. And usually when I see these kinds of films, I would more often than not write off the teen character because I so dislike teenagers. I find her very sympathetic and find her someone that, okay, you know what? She's not being heard. She's not being understood. You know, she's got something to offer and yet nobody wants to give her the time of day. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. It's not the usual teen angst bullshit is what I'm trying to say.
What's the name of it again?
Edge of 17.
Edge of 17. All right, cool. I'm going to have to pull that one out tonight and see if we can find that. And by the way, you mentioned Kira Sedgwick also being in this movie. Am I wrong in thinking that she could live to 150 and she would still be sexy until the day she dies?
Well, she may be the poor man's Julia Roberts, but she's a cutie. She's a cutie. Kevin Bacon done good.
Yeah, you know? No doubt.
He done real good, you know? She's a smart – she's also a very smart woman. You know, they got wiped out in the whole what's his name?
Oh, yeah, I know who you're talking about. Right, the guy who stole everybody's money. Guy.
Yeah. Madoff.
Bernie Madoff, yeah.
She immediately took a series that turned out to be a massive success on TNT.
Yep.
You know, to get money back into the bank. He works like 500 days a year.
Right.
And she just keeps...
She did the closer, and that was a great show. As procedurals go, that was a really good one.
And she did this movie, and just, you know, very smart family. Nice people. They seem like really nice people.
Good. Well, you know, they speak highly of you.
Well, you know what? Look, as I said to a friend the other day, I know what it's like to be a cult hero. You know, I have my following. I have my minions. I have my worshipers and my disciples, and when the time comes, they will do my bidding, of course. But at least they all speak highly of me. They don't speak of me as some kind of cult leader, but rather their beacon of hope.
Attaboy.
As I deign myself to be.
Well, let's jump into a little bit more music. And in fact, let's jump into books about music before we do anything else, because you've got a new one out from Kurt Weiss this week. What's Kurt Weiss writing about?
Well, Mr. Weiss, who, just to give you a little bit of background, began his career as, shock horror, when we get to the meat of the story here, is a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
Who played under the glorious pseudonym of Louis King, as he played in a band called the Rock Cats. But then he went on to play in one of my favorite bands of the era, Beat Rodeo. Okay. Great drummer, incredibly nice man, incredibly intelligent, and a fantastic writer. He has written his first biography, and it's about Jerry Nolan of the New York Dolls. Now, the great thing about this book is the fact that it's one of those books where I'm more prone to naturally enjoy, and I think it might be a problem that I do have, the predisposition to immediately be prejudiced about reading books on people I know,
okay,
or know about, because I'm going to think, oh, you know, you're really inaccurate here, or that never happened, or whatever the case. It's like I really try to never read books about the Beatles,
mm-hmm,
because it's problematic. Or The Who, or Paul Weller, or whomever. Because I know nothing, really nothing about the New York Dolls, except for, you know, obviously David Johansen, Syl Sylvain, and since that movie, New York Doll, about Arthur Kane. You know, and I was never a great fan of Johnny Thunders, so the only other heartbreaker slash New York Doll is Jerry Nolan.
Right.
He's written a book about Jerry Nolan, and I gotta say, it's one of those books you don't put down when you start reading it, because it's fascinating and it's riveting. That's how good the writing is. Now, the story itself, the character, Jerry Nolan himself, was definitely what I would not consider somebody I would like. I thought he was a dick from everything I was reading, because he just came off as a creep and predatory. You know, he became a junkie late, actually, and he picked up his habit later than most heroin addicts tend to do, but he was such a severe addict that he was the type of person that would turn younger people on to heroin, which was, I thought, as reprehensible as you could get.
Yeah.
You know, he turned on girlfriends to heroin so he could use them and manipulate them so he could get money and stuff to get money so he could get drugs. He was really just an unfeeling son of a bitch. But that's what makes the story so likable, because you can formulate an opinion. Listen, there are people who thought of him as sympathetic. Fuck that. He was a predatory junkie creep. That's, you know, I'm very black and white about these things. The one thing I will say is when you go back and you listen to something like the New York Dolls, whose music was ramshackle at best, and then you go back and you listen to the Heartbreakers, who, even though they recorded one studio album, Jerry Nolan is the anchor that holds that band's album together, because his drumming is so military, on time, 1, 2, 3, perfect, because of the sloppiness of Johnny Thunder's junky guitar playing and Walter Lurb starting to become a fuck up himself. You know, it was Jerry Nolan who held it down. And the problem is, though, Jerry Nolan could not hold anything down for more than a short period of time. In every band that he was ever in, he got kicked out by everybody.
Yeah.
You know? He was in a band in the 60s. He got kicked out. They signed a record deal. You know, the New York Dolls basically broke up because him and Johnny were such junkies that the other three said, fuck you, and left them in a trailer park in Florida. You know?
Yeah. And telling that kind of story, I mean, from that perspective and getting it all right is an important thing. And unfortunately, too many of the sort of autobiographical tell-alls are so apocryphal, because they try to just gin everything up and take it to the next level, even when it wasn't, that it becomes obvious that, okay, we're making this a little more lurid just for added pub.
But the thing is that there really isn't – one of the key things about the foreword is the fact that there isn't as much as you would expect, and there are certain sources that would not allow him to do the work necessary.
Right.
You know, so to be blocked at certain points when you need information because you're trying to write an honest account of something, that's not helpful. But he made the best out of a very difficult research chore, really. And the way he wrote it and the way he delivered it is absolutely sterling. I mean, he's just such a good. I am dying to see what he writes next, if it's going to be another factual book or if he attempts fiction, because he can write.
Yeah.
He's gifted. That's the key thing. As far as Jerry Nolan goes, you know, it didn't really make me go running back to listen to any more than New York Dolls than I already have. But I did revisit the one Heartbreakers, not Tom Petty's.
Yeah, the other Heartbreakers, right.
Right, the Heartbreakers that didn't make it. The Heartbreakers' one studio album, LAMF, which, you know, it's arguable that of the first wave of punk albums, it's good. It could have been great. The potential was there when you listen to the songs. And, you know, the big problem with that record, as everyone knows, is there were so many variations on the mix that it took forever for it to finally come out. And when it finally came out, it sounded like shit.
Yeah, it was muddy. Yeah.
Well, but when you hear the current new version, the remix, it sounds great. It really does, because Chinese Rocks is possibly one of the three best original wave punk singles.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. Well, that book is Stranded in the Jungle, Jerry Nolan's Wild Ride. I have one to pass off to you as well, because I got to have a little conversation with the author this week. A couple of years ago, Kent Hartman, who is a longtime rock writer, he released the book that was the story behind the movie about the Wrecking Crew. And that was outstanding. I mean, the movie itself, the documentary is fantastic. And Ken Hartman's book about it is equally so. He's got a new one out, and it's called Goodnight LA. And it's effectively, it's the story of what happened just after, like, Laurel Canyon was starting to fade away, and the LA music scene went from the 60s to the 70s. And it starts with a young guy by the name of Robert Wachtel going to the store with his mom and seeing a guitar hanging on the wall and saying, I want one of those. And it just goes on from there. So it's the rise of, oh, Linda Ronstadt and Stone Pony. It's the rise of Fleetwood Mac. It's the rise of all of these different bands. And the story...
He's got to be part of this whole thing.
Oh, yeah. And the story of the producers who were putting these chess pieces together and moving them all around the board of popular music, where with Laurel Canyon, it was who was getting high at whose house tonight. And in the 70s, it was more about the producers saying, you know what, that voice sounds better with that guitar than it does with that one. So I'm going to take this guy and put him in this band. That's how Loggins and Messina ended up getting together. So it's another fascinating book by him. And he tells a story about Fleetwood Mac during the Rumours sessions, which would have been, what, 76?
Yeah, I mean, that was, yeah, don't forget, you know, just to give background to our audience who may not know, Fleetwood Mac is actually originally a fully British band.
Right, a blues band.
Right, led by, it was called Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
Because Peter Green was the lead singer, main writer, and head guitarist.
Right.
The thing is that they relocated after Peter Green had left, and they picked up Bob Welch, the late Bob Welch, as guitarist and singer. They stayed in the United States. For some odd reason, began to make headway. They were kind of in a jazz kind of, you know, they went from being the strict blues rock band they were into this more mellowed sound.
Yep.
And then they picked up this young couple from, I believe it was from Arizona, was where they originally were based.
Right.
Lindsey Buckingham and his girlfriend Stephanie Nix.
Right.
And they joined at the last minute at the suggestion of, what was it, Keith Forsey was the... Was that the name of the producer?
Oh, Keith is the right first name, and for crying out loud, I just read the book. You'd think I'd have this, but yeah, it was his suggestion that they join the band, and he was also
his house,
right? And he ended up working with Tom Petty later on. So yeah, I mean, it's everybody knows everybody, and Petty's a big part of the book as well. But they get into the Rumours sessions, and there's so much cocaine and so much paranoia and so much weirdness going on between the band that at one time, the engineer and the producer decide they're going to play a prank on the band. And the engineer fills up a Ziploc bag full of baby powder, takes it in the studio, and leaves it on top of a piano. And when the band arrives, he walks in and pretends to trip and knock the whole bag of baby powder on the floor. He said they almost killed him. They were screaming at him, "You dumb son of a bitch!" And they were. It was this close to getting physical because they were that dependent. And he said, "It really, as much as it was a prank gone wrong, it turned into a wake up call for the band because, in their words, later on, they said, you know, the music was still number one, but cocaine gave it a damn good run for its money."
Well, I mean, remember there's that line that Graham Nash said about David Crosby the day that they were having a rehearsal and Crosby's hash pipe fell off the amp,
yeah.
The vibes and broke, and you know, Crosby stopped in the middle of his song to run and get it before it hit the ground.
Yeah.
And that's when Nash said, "Fuck this guy." the day that drugs come before the music, I'm out of here.
Exactly, right.
You know, so, kind of thing, but yeah, I mean, Fleetwood Mac were notoriously high on cocaine, and you know, the infighting because of the breakup of the marriages within the group. I mean, Christine McVie and John McVie fell apart, and Stevie and Lindsay had broken up, and she started hooking up with Mick Fleetwood,
and
who was married to Jenny Boyd,
right?
And that ended, and you know, he went back to Jenny Boyd for a long time before that finally ended on its own volition, but. I mean, Jesus, you know. And if I'm not mistaken, Stevie also had an affair with Tom Petty around the time of Stop Dragging My Heart Around.
She says no, because she was still sleeping with a producer at that point. But who knows? I mean, everybody was screwing everybody, so.
She slept with two Eagles.
Right.
You know, but for her quote is, "The great love of her life happens to be Joe Walsh."
Oh, really?
Yeah, not the senator, nasty yeah. man, but life's been good to me, you know.
There is only one Joe Walsh. Fuck right, that guy.
Your prick head and walk away.
You know? Yeah, crazy stuff, man. But yeah, so that book's called Goodnight LA, so definitely another one to check out if you have not
yet. I've got to read that. That sounds wonderful.
Yep.
I will look for it tomorrow and get it.
Good deal. And we've got some more new music to talk about. In fact, new music that's profiled elsewhere on Popdos, and you have not only the review of the new music, review of the new single, but also a conversation with one of our favorites. Sean Kelly from A Fragile Tomorrow has new music out, and this time it's under his own name. What's going on with the band? Let's start there.
Okay, the band is still together, and they're working on new material. It's just that, as you and I have talked about, unfortunately, they went through a lot of trauma this last year. They lost the Kelly brothers, Sean, his twin brother, drummer Dominic, and their brother Brendan, who's the lead guitarist. They lost their grandfather last year, and then they lost their mother Vicky after a very, very long and brave battle with cancer a couple of short months ago.
And she was very much the band mom.
Yeah, she was so beloved. You know, she was somebody that reached out to everybody who came into connection with the band. She was truly that. She wasn't just the band mom. She was a fan.
Yeah.
And you've got to love a person that's like that, yep. You know, because she was young. You know, she was younger than me. You know, so that's really, it's heartrending when you think about it in the grand scheme of things. But this was kind of in the offing, you know, as Sean says in the conversation, he'd been going through changes. You know, he was getting married. You know, they'd moved away from home. You know, they'd moved away from the family home, I should say, in Charleston. And he and Dominic had relocated to Savannah, Georgia, where they built and opened up a recording studio of their own. You know, so all these life changes were starting to happen. And they, you know, after the actual quite inward making success of Make Me Over. You know, they decided to take a little break from it. You know, they've been doing this. They're young men. They're only like 25, 26 years old.
So
they've been doing this for 13, 14 years since they were little
life.
Children.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
So, you know, a break is in order. Do something different. And so, you know, Dom did a folk sort of album, you know, an acoustic album, considering even though he's the drummer, he's a multi-instrumentalist. Sean wanted to do something a little different, and what he did was he looked back at the 80s and he started to listen to the very high-ended production things like Peter Gabriel and David Bowie. And when you hear the album, which is called Time Bomb Baby, you can tell the very obvious influences, the very obvious production styles. In a way, it's an immediate throwback.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. what I got out of it, in fact, there's a song you've got on the page called Syncopation, and the first thing that jumped out at me was the use, the very, very clever use, and this is where that splitting the stereo, going all the way to the left or all the way to the right, and having those things sort of knock off of each other in the middle. That controlled noise that bands like in the later 80s, like the Butthole Surfers were playing with, there's a lot of that that comes through, and I love that stuff.
The great thing about you, you and I also are into production, so we can talk about this, and a lot of people aren't going to understand where we're coming from. But the high, to me, the use of one channel, it gives a greater punch. It also reminds me of those old Beatles records,
yes.
The old Capitol records.
Right.
Turn the one channel, it's all the music and no vocals coming out on the left. Pan left and it's just the vocals. And the beauty of doing it that way was the fact that, okay, I can sing along with the music so I can get my voice right.
Right.
That was how I always did it and how I always saw it. And if I ever sent you some of my demos, you can hear that some of those demos, I decided to go in that direction. Now, granted, you know, recording on cassette is a completely different kettle of fish, but you pan to one channel, you get all the guitars in one, and the bass and the drums in the other, and dead center are all the voices.
Yeah.
You're limited. Who the fuck knows what I can do with 32-track digital?
Yeah.
Don't ask me. I haven't gone down that road just yet.
But it's a very clever style. It really is.
It is. And the great thing, and you know, you and I have talked about this so many times about A Fragile Tomorrow, but certainly Sean and the rest of the band, but Sean now, because we're talking about this album, is a very astute student of different musics, and they've always been. You know, when they did Be Nice, Be Careful, you could tell they were going down the very clearly down the road of REM and Big Star. No messing. No question. The last record, you could tell they'd gotten into 70s pop, rock, power pop, you know, that they were digging the Cheap Trick and, you know, and ELO.
Sitting on the sideline,
the bass part of
it. Waiting for my turn.
Back to the main track, not the
expectations.
But, Eno was working with Talking Heads. Before he got flat and boring sounding with U2,
yeah.
And some of the Steve Lillywhite touch. Because to me, you and I have talked about this, Steve Lillywhite, to me, was the producer of the 80s. Steve Lillywhite and U Padgham, who worked side by side, because U Padgham was more often than not Steve Lillywhite's engineer. You know,
right.
So those two guys were just, you know, a magnificent tandem. So the thing is that this record is something different for Sean to do. And he freely admits that, you know, he's got his moments of trepidation about it, but you know, I did ask him some of the pointed questions, like, you know, are the band going to be getting back together? Yes, no doubt. Will you be doing a solo tour? Probably. When the band gets back together, will you incorporate any of the songs from your album or from Don's album or, you know, Brendan or Sean Rhodes, the bass player, if they decide to do solo records, would you? The answer is yeah. At least one from each solo record,
right.
Going forward.
Just very but, relaxed.
Right. And he says it very pointedly, and you can't help but think maybe it's because it's a predominantly family band. He says the exciting thing about taking a year off is that we get to reevaluate when we finally come back together and reassess how we've worked out what the solo things are going to be in the context of the band. So you still have the band at the center of the orbit, you know? They're still the main atomic particle, and these are the little offshoots.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing, instead of going, well, you know, now I'm going to start my solo career, and, you know, now I can edge myself away, you know.
Yeah, either way, it's well worth following all of them. And the great thing about them is not only are they, you know, can you follow them as they tour, But they've got a great social media presence, so definitely want to check all of them out, but get the new one from Sean Kelly. And the Brothers Prince, we had talked about them not that long ago. They were one of those bands that we looked at and went, oh, I know what these guys are going to sound like, and then listened to them and went, oh, shit, I was wrong.
and then we said right afterwards, oh, shit, that was really fucking good.
Exactly, but, and they've done it again.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, granted, ironically, their debut EP is called Single, and it's only three songs, but I like the fact that they're holding back, and instead of doing, like, six or seven songs or whatever, it's just three songs, and they put Sun to Rise, which was the one that we premiered back in the beginning of June. But the other two tracks, Finish Last, you know, I'll get right to the heart of the matter. The music itself is fantastic. You know, I love the sound of the 70s soul funk kind of feel, and the way they make it sound makes it sound like it came from that period. You know, yep. It's very dry, it's very, you could tell it's real instruments, it's not bullshit. But what I don't like are the rap-style vocals. I don't like it one bit because the guy can sing.
Yeah.
You're wasting time and wasting your talent. You can sing. Don't rap. Let rappers rap. You're not a rapper. You're a singer. Be proud of that. You know, rappers rap because they can't sing. Fucking sing. You know, you've got these great backing vocals and harmonies. Sing.
Yeah, so we'll see what the direction takes. And I mean, do we know whether they're going to turn this EP into a full-fledged album or whether they're going to just continue to record more stuff?
I think they're going to come up with an album. Whether these songs appear on that album, that yet to be seen. I mean, then that would be the third time that Sun to Shine, you know, appears on an album. Then that becomes a little redundant. But, you know, it's you know, the third track, so musical, it's very warm. It's very upbeat, and it's pure soul. We're talking about the kind of soul you and I, when we say soul, we know what we mean.
Right.
You know? So it's got the feel. It's got the funk. I think they're off to a really good start, but I would like to see them come up with, for argument's sake, maybe six or seven new songs. You don't have to go full 12-song album. Maybe six songs, okay? Six song, another EP, a mini album, and go for that. And keep building it up, because the more you build up in this way, the more people are going to start saying, hey, want to hear some more from you.
Exactly.
You put out a great single. Then you put out these great three songs. Now you put out these next six songs. More. You know, that's what you want. Leave them wanting more.
There was, before we get to In Our Heads, there was certainly plenty to talk over in terms of, again, the self-congratulations parade over, oh, we're doing such a great job in Puerto Rico, which, no, you're not. And people are still, you know, without water and without power and without food, and it's a mess. They do have paper towels, that's right, because he threw some to three or four people. Schmuck. And there was a lot there, but since we're talking on Sunday and this just happened, one of the most heinous things that I think the influences of the last 20 years has been this manufactured outrage bullshit, where you find something to pretend to be angry about because, well, you just feel like you have to say something, and I can't stand it. So when I see somebody go the next step with it and do what the Vice President of the United States did today, it makes me sick. What he did was he went to the Indianapolis Colts game because he's an Indiana guy. He was governor of Indiana before he was VP. So went to the Colts game and immediately left because he said that he had an agreement with the president that if anybody disrespected the flag, i.e., you know, held a peaceful protest about, you know, police violence and all of that, that he was going to walk out. Well, what did you think they were going to do? Of course he knew they were going to kneel down before the, you know, during the national anthem. So they sent him there specifically as a platform to act like a manufactured outrage dick. And he walked right into it and did it. And now, you know, again, it started the whole social media uproar on both sides. And it was just the most contrived bullshit thing I could think of. And he's the vice president of the. So for all the people, by the way, who have been saying, gee, I wish they'd get Trump out just so we could have Pence in. Sure, he's an asshole, but at least he's a, you know, he means well. Does he? Does he really?
He doesn't know what he means. He doesn't know anything. He's a moron.
Right.
He's always been a moron, besides being a heinous individual. But we're coming at that from being politically astute human beings, not being social justice warriors and, you know, easily outraged by any little bullshit that comes along. Because you know what? If that was the case, I'd be screaming at you because I have to eat Kit Kat, darker chocolate, and white chocolate minis, motherfucker. See, that's the whole thing. I get outraged when I see things like this. Yo, this is racially insensitive.
That's right. Milk chocolate outrages me too, but what can I tell you?
Well, you know what? Actually, if you think about it, milk chocolate is the perfect one of all because it's a little bit of milk and a little bit of chocolate. You got the right mix of everything, baby. That's how it's got to groove together.
Or as they once said on a TV show I can't even remember the name of, but it was one of my favorite lines, half black is nature's Photoshop.
That sounds like something that would have come out of Tommy Chong's mouth on that 70s show.
Yeah, right. Something like that. But yeah, it just makes you want to throw your hands up and go, you know what? Nobody's paying attention anyway. Screw
it. You know what? You just hit it right on the head. It's the throwing that because you're a rational human being. You get it. I get it. That's why, as some very wise man had, posted on his Facebook page about Pence going to see this, would he get up and walk out of a performance of Rent? My response to that was very simply, fuck, I would, because Rent sucks.
Yeah, right.
To start. And if you're not from New York, then you're definitely going to like Rent because it's the tourist's kind of musical.
Exactly.
There's a sucker born every minute, as P.T. Barnum once said. Right now, we are living in a world of suckers.
Yep.
Because it is so easy to set somebody off. I guarantee you, you and I could concoct a really believable, completely contrived, formulated rumor that would piss everyone off, get us both killed, of course. But we could sell it without even trying because people are that willingly malleable and dumb.
Right.
And the willing ignorance is the most offensive thing of all because you have a lot of really intelligent people out there who are falling for this hook, line, and sinker. And that's offensive.
Right.
That's offensive. That's criminal and negligent. And I'm going to say something right now. I have a lot of real-life friends who also are on Facebook who – it galls me, and actually some of them are friends of yours and mine mutually. It galls me that they get on Facebook and they ape the platitudes that everybody else has already aped for I don't know how long at this point.
Right. Think.
And it comes, it comes out as so fey and so transparent and so phony and so hypocritical and so – that's the definition of sheep. When you start to buy into this kind of thing without really thinking about the big picture, it's always about the big picture and no one gets it. And the faux outrage, it's like, what are you going to be pissed off about again next week? See, I have a reason to be pissed off. I'm stuck with fucking milk chocolate, not goddamn white chocolate.
Right.
White chocolate lives matter. Hashtag gimme vanilla fudge. That's legitimate. Okay. See, it's tangible. Again, people, you can't see it, but I'm holding physical product up. Right. And John can see what I'm holding.
Kit Kat Minis. So, absolutely.
This is legitimate grievance here.
Right.
The shit that people get themselves all bunched up about on the net and on Facebook, especially because Facebook seems to be the only place anyone lives anymore.
Right.
Is that nobody is taking the time to do the work and the research. They will all read one stupid fake news story. And believe me, when I say fake news, I mean everything that you will probably see 99 times out of 100 on Facebook is fake news. They're from these horrific websites that don't give a shit about anything political. They say they're left-leaning. They say they're right-leaning. They just want advertising dollars so that they can keep going. That's all it is.
Right.
So they make shit up as they go along. But people buy it, and they spread the rumors because Facebook is the giant game of telephone. That's all it is.
Right. And it gets just as garbled just as fast. And
you know what else throughout history was the giant book of telephone until Facebook? The Bible.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And willful ignorance, you're right. That is the worst part of it, because without the willful ignorance, the manufactured outrage doesn't work. Because if you are thinking about an issue, you have to be able to concede that some of your first blush thoughts about it were probably wrong. And on deeper thought, you get to different conclusions and you get to different levels. And if you can't do that, then don't just sit there and blather away on Facebook, because you're doing yourself a disservice. You're doing a disservice to everybody else who's reading the tripe and the crap that it's just everywhere, rampant on Facebook. But you're also showing that you have no capacity for rational, really hard fought and hard worked out thoughts and conclusions, and no capacity for original thought at all.
the more I read things that are written and posted by people that I actually know in the real world, I become more disappointed by them because they just seem to, and I'm not putting myself above anyone. It's just that if you go on my Facebook page, you're not going to find any of this kind of nonsense because I refuse. I refuse to absolutely denigrate myself to this kind of thing, be it left-leaning or right-leaning, because they're both full of shit.
Yep.
And I don't believe or trust either side, you know? And here's a big problem. The word, and I had this wonderful conversation this morning with my wife, but the word conservative, like so many other words nowadays, has been co-opted and attempted at rewriting. Conservative is a very clear definition. Conservative means thoughtful and rational, you know? Conservative means looking at the big picture and what is the best route to take for all parties concerned. And I'm not talking about political parties. I'm talking about, you know, we're on a road trip. What's the best means for us to get there for all parties concerned? Do we take I-95, which will take us 6 hours? It's not scenic, but it's a straight run. Or do we take Route 13, which is 8.5 hours? Oh, but you can see the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What's the best for everybody concerned? You take the conservative way because it helps everybody.
Yeah.
Conservatism has been co-opted and ruined by both the left and the right. The conservatives, quote unquote, the political conservatives, have opted to use that word in alignment with the Christian right, which is a very nebulous and negative connotation because conservatism is wisdom. General conservatism is wisdom. It means economic smart, you know, not throwing away every damn dollar on these whimsical, stupid, you know, cause celebs of the week. The left have taken the word conservative and made it dirty because right away you're aligned with
Rush Limbaugh.
And Rush Limbaugh and everyone's a Nazi. No, no. That's another word that you and I refuse to use unless you're talking about somebody getting the shit kicked out of them in Seattle, deservedly so.
Right.
The fact is people sit there and they love the sound of their own voice, even in the written format. They love their own bluster. And they love to get worked up with their friends because it makes them feel a part of something. Because especially when it's people of our age range, there's obviously a void in them. It's not a knock and it's not meant as an insult. There's obviously with a lot of people that you and I know right now, they are going through what I call the new infantilism, which is frightening.
Yeah.
They're turning back into the pissing and moaning teenagers that we all were, you know?
Yeah, you're right. It's not a progression, it's a regression. And that's, again, it's not good for anybody. We've already been there and it wasn't that great. So just keep that in mind. And just think about things. And it doesn't matter if you come to the same conclusion I do. Just think. Do your job. Do your work. Think about shit. That's the work of being an American. So that said, I think we can safely...
Adult, a reasonable, yeah. Rational adult.
Right.
Stop pretending. Stop carrying that youth flag of yours. It's over. Okay? When you pass the age of 30, officially, it's over. When you've passed the age of 50... it's beyond an embarrassment.
Yeah, exactly. That brings us quite nicely into the In Our Head segment, and we're going to go into something this week that it occurred to me because I don't even know why, but it was just every so often a song floats through your head that you haven't heard in a long time. Maybe somebody says a word or two from a line, and it just reminds you of what a great thing that piece of music was. And we've mentioned soul music a couple of times during this conversation, and in the early days of what became the R&B and soul of the early 1960s, when it was really starting to define itself, before the whole world sounding even came into existence, there was a string of just absolutely beautiful soul hits, and the one that started playing in my head was a song called Forever My Darling by, to use Paul Simon's words, the late great Johnny
Make this fire in my soul, dear, forever.
that song to me defines the beauty of that particular era. And I think that song came out in 1958. And between that and probably three or four other songs, it set that style of music off on a course that led to, oh man, the Temptations and so many other great bands that took it the next level. But Forever My Darling by Johnny Ace is just absolutely gorgeous. Now, the thing about that song, and what brings me to the In Our Heads segment and what I want you to do with it, is I came to that song via a movie soundtrack. It was playing during a movie that I was sitting there, and I thought, I gotta go buy this thing now. I have to buy a soundtrack. I've never bought a soundtrack to a movie before. I'm gonna have to buy one because that song is gorgeous and I don't know where else to get it.
Don't you know?
What was a song that you didn't know about before you saw it?
We're spoken by the
we don't have to shout. And I know we can talk the thing out of our head.
What's up, Tiger?
That's right, yes.
And they're doing this thing, and I was like, what the fuck?
Let's call every word barrier broken.
Yep.
This song's incredible, and I ran out and I bought a copy of What's Up Tiger Lily. Considering I had, you know, as a kid, I had the Daydream, the Hums of a Loving Spoonful, and the Do You Believe in Magic albums. So in the process, I also wound up picking up the soundtrack to You're a Big Boy. Now, I picked up the rest of the album catalog is what I did.
Yeah.
You know, I picked up the soundtrack to Tiger Lily, You're a Big Boy Now, Everything Playing, and even their final album, after John Sebastian had left, Revolution Revelation 69, which is a pretty dire record.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's two good songs in it. But yeah, that was one for sure. That was as a kid. I was, what, 11, 12 years old maybe.
Right.
Later on, I remember going to see Athens GA Inside Out and hearing the Kilkenny Cats for the first time. I also heard Time Toy and loving what I heard. And the thing was, I went out and I bought the soundtrack to the movie the next day, and the song that I wanted from the Kilkenny Cats was not on the LP.
Oh, yeah.
Most bands got two songs that were shown in the movie, but it wasn't included on the album. That was one of those that wasn't included on the album, which was really upsetting. But at the same time, that was a movie, because it was a documentary about, you know, a music scene, there were so many great songs in that movie. I mean, Dream's So Real, a song called – it's either called Golden or Steps, either or. But it was so good, and when you heard them record it in the movie, I'm like, I got to get this.
Right.
This is just amazing. And again, the track from Time Toy is also Out of This World. So that was another one that, you know, definitely was a main soundtrack.
Well, it's Saturday night in Austin Green. I ain't really bothering me. Eating by the monster of love. It's hard to fight it off much more. I hear it turning by the door. Eating by the monster of love. It ain't a pretty sight to see the way.
Sparks Monster of Love, through the soundtrack in the valley.
With those goo-gooing eyes, six super smiles, it used to rise. And my father said, don't worry, son, but look at him, he should have run, eaten by the monster of love.
And that's another one that just, it's full of outstanding music. There's a lot of garbage in it too, just pop tripe, but there's some really interesting songs in that soundtrack.
You know, we were talking about Bachelor Party not long ago. That had a fucking amazing soundtrack. Wind Out by REM, American Beat 84 by the Fleshtones.
Who was the band? Who was the band that was in
that
was?
That was what, Angel in the Reruns.
Yes, right.
Buffy, Come Back to Me. Why'd You Have to Go? And OD.
And they were fantastic. I mean, and they looked great in the movie too. So that didn't hurt.
That was the band. Yeah, I mean, unlike in say Back to School. I can't believe it, Lou. Married to Vanessa for 4 years. I remember, just like it was yesterday. And you know what a lousy day yesterday was. Jason, I'm your father. You don't lie to your father. You lie to girls.
That's right. And
yeah, but that was at Boingo.
Exactly. Yeah, Oingo Boingo, because he hired them to play the party.
But they also were playing Everybody's Crazy by Bolton.
Yes. Too
what?
Much. Well, and of course, I mean, there were, that era was also rife with a lot of really good concert movies. Remember those, kids? I mean, the first time that I saw Erg a Music War.
And there was Dance Craze, which if you were in a place like New York City, you were lucky enough to see, which was the movie about the ska scene in England.
Right. And of course, Stop Making Sense, even though that one was band specific, still a great movie. And again, a visual, kids, because you can't see this at home, but Rob's doing the cut on the arm thing. Yes.
The David Byrne thing.
Right.
How did I get here? I don't know, because you're pretentious. How the fuck do I know? Leave me alone. I don't like talking about it. See, that's another good reason. You know, that's the other thing, Quadrophenia. When we saw Quadrophenia, you know, it had songs that, of course, were from the album Quadrophenia, but then there were the James Brown tracks. There are certain movies that you're just going to have to go out and get the soundtrack, you know, and we're not talking about the Beatles, for God's sake.
Blues Brothers.
Right. The Blues Brothers. And the thing is, the Blues Brothers album itself still surpasses the soundtrack because,
yeah.
Well, the good version of Gimme Good Lovin', Gimme Some Lovin', but the old Spencer Davis group
song. Yeah,
Gimme
Some Lovin'.
You know, nothing will surpass Briefcase Full of Blues, because that's the album that's got Hey Bartender, their version, their dead on version of Soul Man,
mm-hmm.
I Can't Turn You Loose, and most importantly, Rubber Biscuit.
Yes, which is also a remake, and that's another one of those that can go into the next time we start talking about remakes that nobody knows are remakes. Sure,
that's very, although the first thing he says, you know, now my brother Elwood's gonna sing a little song, it's a song by the Chips.
Yep.
You know, and then, you know, you know what scares me is that I first heard that album 39 years ago, and I can still do a dead-on perfect Rubber Biscuit, which scares the living shit out of me.
Something to be proud of.
Absolutely. It's like my you know, imitation of, well, you know.
Thank you, Jello. Oh, man. I love it.
Was, you know, going back to another segment that we have already done, you're going to know me the moment I say this. Most annoying fucking song that we absolutely overlooked, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, you sons of bitch. That fucking song is – I can't understand it because I really liked Wham. But, man, you know, if George Michael wasn't dead, God rest his soul, I'd punch him in the fucking face just because of that song. I hate that song. So I'm going to find Andrew Ridgely and punch him in absentia.
Yeah, just punch him so hard that you know that he'll feel it.
And I'm going to punch him so hard that he can't do anything with Karen Dallin from Bananarama anymore after 30 years. And I'm going to take her because she still looks good.
Attaboy.
You know, because that is just – that fucking song is unacceptable on any level. It is a song that is so bad, you would rather be beaten by a nun in Catholic school. You will take the physical beating, and I'm not even Catholic. That's how bad this song is, okay?
Well,
I would rather have explosive diarrhea than have to hear that fucking song.
I think they did while they were recording it. And we're going to leave it at that, but you know, now I'm going to have to, as an ear cleanser, I'm going to go after not only listen to Johnny Ace, but also listen to Robert and Johnny and the rest of them just singing some soul classics and make myself feel better.
Except don't listen to Johnny Come Home by Fine Young Cannibal.
Yeah.
We're worried. Won't you come on?
Rob Ross, have a good week, my man.
You too, brother. I'll see you later.